Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lost in Science. We're so happy to have you with us. My name is Lyndon, and with me in the studio for another half an hour of science in your earbones, it's Chris. How you going, Chris?
Good earbones, did you say?
Yeah,
I said. Well, they are earbones, aren't they?
Yeah. What's that question? It's that famous quiz question. Like, what's the smallest bone in the body? And it's one of the earbones. That's where the science goes. I stand by it.
Oh, well done.
How are you and your earbones?
They're good. They're good. I have some science for you. I have an interview in particular I'm afraid is going to dominate the whole show. It's going to take over the show. It's a Chris takeover.
I'm sure you wouldn't have brought an interview to the show without it being a valuable one to take over the whole episode. Who are you talking to this week, Chris?
Well, look, Lyndon, I'm sure that you're aware that there's a lot of anti-science kind of stuff in the world that we're in at the moment.
Yeah, misinformation and disinformation is considered high up there in one of the big problems to worry about economically moving forward. One of the biggest contributions to global instability, I believe, the anti-science movement.
It is, it is. And that view is shared by the authors, that's plural, of the a new book. It's called Science Under Siege. And it is about this very issue. It's about this book is by two people who have experience of two major issues where facing, you know, science versus anti-science, and their analysis of what are the forces that we're up against as people on the more the pro-science side. So this book is by someone you might be familiar with, climate scientist Michael E. Mann.
Michael Mann, no way. He's kind of a big deal. That's exciting.
He's kind of a big deal. He's, I believe, the creator of the famous hockey stick graph.
Yes, yep, definitely. He was definitely at the forefront of the climate denial kind of movement in the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, he wasn't at the front of it. He was the front of the other team who was being attacked by, climate deniers back when... Actually, I was getting into climate science and it seemed to be a very, very scary place to be. I think of him as a very brave man, but what's he like to have a chat with?
He's pretty good. We've spoken to him on the show before. This time we're talking about this particular issue of, facing denial and, I suppose, an anti-science viewpoint. What kind of other area of science do you think also faces a lot of denialism and...
They're Americans.
Yeah.
I'd want to say vaccines.
You got it right. Hit it right, the nail on the head. Yes. His co-author is Peter Hotez, who was a vaccinologist, let's call him that. Been involved in, I guess, pediatric medicine for a long time, but particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, he was very heavily involved in that and, in fact, developed a COVID-19 vaccine, which wasn't one of the big ones that we've seen in major Western countries. But, he's basically in the forefront of that kind of side of science. And so basically they've found these two...
Big deals
have compared notes and have come up with what they think are the five forces that they think are kind of sum up this threatening science.
Wow. Well, let's get on with the show.
Yes. You're listening to Lost in Science. My name's Chris, and if you're a regular listener to our show, then like us, you're probably also a bit of a fan of science and the good things that it can do for the world. But you're probably also aware that not everyone shares the same views, and that there seem to be growing forces that are threatening the scientific worldview. Now, these threats are outlined in their new book, Science Under Siege, and I'm lucky today to be speaking to the two authors, who are both scientists who serve on the front lines for the battle for science. So we have climate scientist Michael Mann, who created the famous hockey stick graph of global temperatures, which demonstrates, I guess, the recent impact of human-caused climate change. Welcome to the show, Michael.
It's great to be with you, Chris. Thanks.
And we also have Peter Hotez, who's a pediatrician and vaccinologist, who, among other things, developed a vaccine for COVID-19. Nice to meet you, Peter.
Great to join you.
Yeah,
Great to see you.
So I guess you two represent some of the biggest issues that we have seen in recent years, or that ongoing issues that that science has been under threat from. But you, as I said, you've been on the front line. So, and there's, your direct involvement is one of the interesting things. So it gets pretty bad out there, I guess, is what I wanted to find out. It gets quite personal as well, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to talk about my experiences. Peter has complementary experiences. It's sort of what brought us together was the fact that we both found ourselves under attack at somewhat different times. Me really back in the late 1990s when we published the hockey stick curve, and in the decade or two following that, and Peter more recently with his involvement in developing vaccines for the COVID-19.
Yeah, that's actually how I got to meet Michael, because I needed his advice, because he had been, you know, I was like, what the heck is going on here under these attacks? And did this, you know, was there precedent? And sure enough, you know, so Michael became kind of my mentor and advisor on this,
well,
from his, from his unfortunate experiences with climate science. And I learned a lot from him doing that.
Yeah, but right back at you, Peter, I've learned so much from you. And I think our book is much richer because we're able to draw on complementary experiences in these two different spheres. And there are commonalities, and we talk about that quite a bit. There's commonalities in the tactics that are used to discredit science that's in ideologically inconvenient to certain vested interests, be it, you know, the science of vaccines or the science of climate change. There are commonalities in the nature of the character attacks, the way that social media is often weaponized to, you know, undermine scientists and their messaging. And even many of the same actors. And what I thought was really profound, and Peter, this is the first time that we've talked about this. You know, RFK Jr. has been a, you know, one of the most, forgive the pun, virulent critics of vaccines, has made all sorts of unsupported claims about the supposed health threat of vaccines. And so he's been known for his anti-science messaging in that area. But just yesterday, and Peter, I'm not sure if you saw this, he came out and parroted this talking point that we've heard from Donald Trump that's promoted by the fossil fuel industry, this idea that wind energy, that windmills are killing whales. And it's sort of ironic because I think there was an incident where RFK Jr. actually cut the head off of a whale. And I'm not making this stuff up. I wish I was. But he was literally, now RFK Jr., who was once a champion of clean energy when he was a lawyer for NRDC, National Resources Defense Council, is now sort of a full-fledged equal opportunity science denier on both sides, Peter. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I've noticed that in others, that people will start attacking science in one area, and then they decide they have to buy the whole package, and they have to attack, you know, someone will start out, saying that, you know, downplaying the importance of COVID or talking about making false claims about origins of COVID. And before you know it, they're attacking vaccines, and then they're attacking climate science. So it kind of metastasizes among these individuals, and they take it all on.
And this was the challenge of us writing the book. Like, literally every day, there's a new story that we wish we were able to tell in the book, but we can talk about it now because it provides further context for the basic message of the book.
Do you think the other message is, you know, for us, the passion for writing this book is that aside from the personal attacks against us and putting our lives in danger, the bigger message is it's not just an arcane or academic discussion, it's killing people on a big scale. I mean, hundreds of thousands of Americans died because they refused COVID vaccines. They were because they were victims of an organized disinformation empire. And now we can't fight climate science. We can't fight future pandemic threats. So I think what the big driver for, and we start out the book this way, is to say, now there's three existential threats to humankind. It's pandemics, it's climate crisis, climate change, and now the empire that blocks us from taking it on. So
Anti-science.
it's become a tripod,
So I guess this is the interesting thing. Now we thinking about how you started this conversation that you're talking about, what we could learn during COVID from the climate science communication. As someone myself who's been involved in science communication for a while, it seemed to be that a lot of, I guess, what we focus on is talking to the public, is trying to change public opinion and those sort of things. But the challenges, I suppose, as you've outlined, is that you have to deal with forces who are acting against it, what you've just called the disinformation empire. Can you outline a little bit of what are those forces that are actively trying to counter the scientific message?
Yeah, I'll make a quick comment and then I'll let Peter sort of tackle the main thrust of that question. I just wanted to mention there's a cartoon that we just had to show in the book because it's
Oh,
perfect
yeah.
and it sort of encapsulates everything you just said. It's, they're these lab scientists talking to each other. And they're two COVID, vaccinologists, and they're talking to each other. And it's like, if we can just explain the science to the policymakers, then we'll be able to tackle this problem. And you see, and it's like, and then you see this other room that says climate scientists, and you see these two climate scientists that are rolling on the floor laughing, because of course it's this experience that we've had for decades that is so relevant now to what we're sadly seeing Peter and friends of ours like Tony Fauci have to deal with this concern. It's not so much the pseudoscience that Carl Sagan worried about decades ago, and he was so prophetic and worrying about that. But this is even worse. This isn't pseudoscience. This is anti-science. It's even more pernicious. And I'll let Peter take it from there.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's not just, it's two parts to this now. It's not just attacking the science and seeking to discredit the science or proposing alternatives, like ivermectin instead of COVID-19 vaccines, which ivermectin does nothing, but it's also the need to attack the scientists themselves and to portray us as cartoon villains or public enemies. Then it becomes especially pernicious. So it's not only going after seeking to discredit the science, but discrediting the scientists and looking at the motivations for that. In the case of vaccines, a lot of it is the health, wellness, and influencer industry that'll buy up what it can in bulk. And if you ever notice, they're all anti-parasitic drugs like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine or fenbendazole. That's because they're available in bulk and they're cheap, and you can buy them up, jack up the price, and sell it with a telehealth visit. Well, for that sales model to be effective, for the business model, it also means you have to discredit the intervention that actually works. If you're going to sell snake oil, you got to actually discredit the stuff that actually works, like vaccines, and then portray the scientists as bad actors or villains. And fortunately, it's very well financed and it's effective. And then, the political motivation as well. And Michael and I are pretty seasoned now. We're very, I mean, we, you know, Michael supports me a lot when I get depressed, on a bad day and that sort of thing. But,
When I draw upon Peter for support as well, it's a two-way
but,
street. Yeah.
but, But what I really worry about are the young scientists, people coming up, getting their PhDs or MD PhDs or postdoctoral fellowships. They're looking at us like Moses in the desert, why did you bring us here? And I worry that they'll get demoralized and that we'll lose a generation of scientists because of this.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
We're so far.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
You're listening to Lost in Science, and I am speaking to Michael Mann and Peter Hotez, authors of the new book, Science Under Siege.
You asked about what are these different forces, you know, that we identify in the book, and we call them the five Ps. They're the petrostates, you know, Russia, Saudi Arabia, that derive profits from, you know, fossil fuels, and they don't want a clean energy transition, and they seek to discredit climate change and have scuttled, you know, international efforts to to do something about climate change. And for reasons we explained in the book, it turns out that there is these same petrostates also have an interest in promoting other sorts of misinformation and disinformation. And it turns out health misinformation and anti-vax propaganda is also closely tied to sort of these authoritarian petrostates. So it's the petrostates, it's the plutocrats, the billionaires who fund the think tanks and the front groups that exist to attack science, to attack scientists. It is the pros Peter talked about in the public health arena. You have these promoters of anti-science misinformation that actually profit directly by selling miracle cures and potions and false cures and can only do that if they are able to discredit the actual public health. What the public health says about the need for vaccination. And that's the pros on the public health side, but you've also got pros on the climate side. They get paid either directly or indirectly by the fossil fuel industry to promote anti-science, climate change, misinformation and propaganda, to discredit the case for concern about climate change, to discredit the case for clean energy, and to promote business as usual, fossil fuels. And so those are the pros and the propagandists. And I won't get into the distinction between those two. It's sort of subtle. And then finally, there's the press, the conservative press, the Murdoch media. And you folks in Australia are very familiar, because Murdoch has even more control over the media landscape in Australia than he does, say, in the US or Europe. And Rupert Murdoch, who has close ties to the Saudi royal family and the fossil fuel industry, has used his media empire to promote propaganda, misinformation, anti-science misinformation, equal opportunity on climate and on COVID and vaccines as well. So those are the five Ps. And in the book, really, we go through each of them and explain how each of them, you know, the role they play, but they're part of an interwoven sort of network of actors that collectively represent a fundamental threat, a threat to our ability to deal with the two defining crises of our time.
I noticed that there's two other pieces that come to mind that I suppose are the targets of this information. That'd be the politicians, which we've already touched a bit, and the public. Are those two targets that scientists should be aiming for instead of the
I'll let Peter talk about the public. I'll just say the politicians and the polluters, we actually lump that in with the petrostates, because there's a close relationship between those. So those three P's are really represented by petrostates. It's petrostates, but really politicians and polluters, and the way that they collude. And then there's the public, and I'll put that in Peter's court here.
Well, you know, the public, you know, oftentimes I'm being asked to go on Zoom calls about loss of trust in science, public's loss of trust in science. And one of the things that I say is, you know, it's got to be reframed, because too much of it, you know, tries to claim that it was the scientist who miscommunicated or misled. And I don't see it that way. What I see is that it was the bad actors who weaponized what we were saying, and then tried to flip it on its side. It was an epic example of gaslighting on the public. And so that the reason,
no pun intended,
if the public's losing its trust in science, it wasn't, you know, science communication is never going to be perfect, especially during a pandemic or if there's crises, but it was really the bad actors who sought to weaponize it and actively sought to discredit it more than anything else, in my view.
I just add one thing to what Peter just said. Because we talked about the bad actors in the press, you know, the Murdoch media empire, Fox News, the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, The Australian in Australia, Sydney Morning Herald, and this global network that Murdoch wields to promote misinformation and disinformation. It's easy to sort of vilify that, and we do. But as pernicious, and this is a point that Peter and I really try to drive home, are the sort of the legacy media. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the sort of media outlets that we have traditionally drawn upon for objective and authoritative information to the public and to policymakers. And they have really shirked their responsibility here. We describe it as performative neutrality, where they pretend that there are two equal sides when it comes to climate change, when it comes to COVID-19, they not only entertain, but they promote sort of contrarian messaging. They use their editorial pages. They provide space to anti-science advocates attacking climate science or attacking, vaccines. And to Peter and me, that it's particularly dispiriting, because we would have thought that we could count on, again, the sort of the legacy press to do the job that they've historically done. And they've been absent without leave here, in some ways even worse than that, actively working to promote misinformation.
So I guess it is then up for other channels, such as yourselves putting out a book like this, to change the message. What kind of message are you trying to get to readers? What do you want people to take away to help in this battle for science?
Peter?
Well, I think, part of it is to, figure out how we can begin to walk this back. And I think, there's a bunch of moving parts. Mike, put forward this concept in the book of there's no point to doomism, right? Saying there's nothing that could be done. There's a lot that can be done, both in the climate arena as well as the pandemic threats and biomedical arena. But we're going to need to change the culture of science, and scientists need to feel more enabled to speak out. One of the problems in the biomedical side is the academic health centers. The big university medical centers are very much want to control the brand and control the flow of information. They don't necessarily like their docs and their scientists speaking out, and or they'll do it with kind of a veiled threat. Well, you're an academic, you're free to speak out, but don't screw this up and don't get the institution in trouble. And it's hard to feel free to speak out because, if you're out there enough in the public domain, like Michael and I are, eventually you do screw it up and you will get the institution in trouble, and you need to know that we have their backing. And so
younger scientists, right? Who don't necessarily have some of the resources that Peter and I have that we've developed because the connections that we have.
And also the decline in science journalists. Most times now when I talk to a journalist, they have no scientific training, and you spend a lot of time, giving them the background and hoping they get it right. But I think that's where a lot of the false equivalency stuff comes in, because they don't have the self-confidence to know what's real science and what's not. So they present both sides. So, especially with except for the real large news outlets, most news outlets now don't have science journalists. So I think that's also a problem. And also for younger people, for the what we call here in the US K-12, kindergarten through grade 12, before you go to university, we have to rebuild science literacy and critical thinking skills as well. So it's not a quick fix. There's not a magic bullet here.
No.
And then really explaining what this anti-science ecosystem is, because again, we too often frame it as though it's just random junk on the internet, or they call it the infodemic, as though it's just this magical thing that comes down from on high. And it's not. It's organized, it's deliberate, it's politically and financially motivated. And we think that's an important step from the book alone, is to being able to describe the ecosystem so people know what they're up against.
Yeah, you can't defeat an enemy if you don't know who they are. And right. So, I think that's one of the important things that we do that some scientists are a little are uneasy about doing, which is actually naming the names.
We're always told we have to be politically neutral, and I'm actually not very political, and I really don't care that much about your politics. But I say don't adopt this stuff, and reason I explain why so many Americans lost their lives in mostly in Republican majority counties and states is because of the disinformation machine. It's not that I care about your politics, but to say don't adopt this stuff because it's so deadly.
And it's a relatively recent development. I mean, there wasn't a Republican-Democratic divide on science when I was growing up. And there were a lot of Republicans who were very solid on the environment. They're conservative. If you're conservative, don't you want to conserve the environment? Don't you? And there were, environmental champions. Some of the most important environmental legislation was passed by Republican presidents. It was only over the last, decade and a half, really, where things have become so polarized, where some of these vested interests that we talk about, the rise of Fox News, of course, being central here, and the sort of purification of the Republican Party when it comes to issues like climate and when it comes to issues of the environment. That's a relatively recent development. And I think I speak for for both of us, that we would love if there was some way to get back to that time when there were good faith politicians on both sides of the aisle, and we could agree to disagree about the policies, but we could agree upon the facts. Well, we've reached a point where we can't even agree upon the facts, and that's a problem.
Well, there is certainly a lot there to think about. And I, as you said, it's a matter of understanding the forces against us. And I hope that people read your book and learn more about what we're up against so that science and the world can benefit from it. So, look, thank you both for joining us today. It's been great having you here. And yeah, that book, again, it's Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. It's by Michael Mann and Peter Hotez.
Thanks so much. It was my
pleasure. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's it for another episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded for 3CR in Melbourne on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And it airs across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We would love you to get in touch with us. You can email us at lostinsci@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook, we're Lost in Science on 3CR, or on Twitter, where we're at lostinscience1. You can find us on your favourite podcast app, where if you get the chance, please give us a good rating and review, as that will raise us up in the search rankings so other people can find the science. Or you can listen to us however you listen to us now, where at the same time every week, Claire, Stu and Chris get
Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.